To be seen. So Günther will give a series of three sets of lectures today, tomorrow, and after tomorrow. Tomorrow the lectures end at 10:30, right? Because
and it's also in the room down there.
Before. Yes. And then eventually later in November, Günther will come back for a last session, if need be. Günther is at the University of Washington. He's what I call one of the scientific pillar of PIMS. He's organizing the thematic program in Inverse Problems and Applications. He's the chair of the organizing committee. But he's been organizing programs at MSRI, at the IMA, so he's all over the place. He was a PhD, he got his PhD from MIT. Some time ago.
A long time ago.
He was a Sloan Fellow. He had many invited lectureships. The last one was ICM. It's not the last one, but the prestigious one is he was invited to ICM in 98 in Berlin. And we are very happy to have you with us here.
It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I always say that Vancouver is one of my favorite cities in the world. Well, I was warned that this was supposed to be an elementary. Is that right? Still right?
It's still right.
I can see some faces here that know more about this than I do. But to put the also to fix a little bit of the notation. I don't know what the notation you have been using very much. And so let me describe what is the goal of these three lectures, and then. Will be working towards that goal. So what I plan to discuss is the following inverse problem. So you take a bounded domain in Euclidean space and I'm going to assume always for simplicity that the boundary is smooth. And associated to this domain, we have a function of a matrix. In general, it's a matrix. So let me call gamma j of x. It's a positive definite matrix. And symmetric. That represents the conductivity of this domain omega. So gamma is the conductivity. Okay, and it's anisotropic because the conductivity depends on direction. So you say rotate this domain, the conductivity changes when you change. For instance, muscle tissue is very anisotropic. The conductivity in the longitudinal direction is very different than the transversal one. So it's in general it's a matrix. And it's isotropic if this matrix is actually behaves the same in every direction. So it's some positive function, so delta j is 1 if I is equal to j, 0 if I is different from j, and alpha is positive function on omega. Okay. So I don't know how much I'm repeating myself, so. So under the assumptions of no sources or sink of current,
Why can't it have an anti-symmetric part?
Well, the conductivity is there is a positive definite quadratic form that is associated to this.
For example, Hall conductivity has an anti-symmetric part.
The what?
Hall conductivity.
Well, I'm going to assume there is a symmetric and positive definite. It can be complex, for instance. I'm assuming also it's real value. This is just one model of. And in fact, I'm not going to really talk much about this case. I'm just going to talk about the isotropic case. Okay, under the assumption no sources or sinks of current, the equation for the potential is given by the divergence equal to zero. So this is, you should always think in the isotropic case, on omega. For instance, in the isotropic case, it's a more familiar equation, is that the divergence of gamma gradient u equal to zero. So this is the divergence of the current is equal to zero. I'm assuming there are no sources or sinks of current. And this is the more general form of the equation. Okay? So I'm going to assign a voltage potential on the boundary, F. So we're going to put electrodes around the body, and I'm going to assign the voltage potential, and we're going to measure is the voltage to current map which is, let me denote it by lambda gamma of F. Restricted to the boundary, where the U is the solution of this problem. So this equation with this boundary condition. Okay? So this represents, so let's take the isotropic case. Is gamma times the normal derivative at the boundary. So here mu is always a unit out the normal to the boundary. And this represents the current flux at the boundary. Okay? So this is the model that we're going to use. It's a model, I mean, like anything else. And these are the components of the new I, are the components of this outer normal. Okay, so the inverse problem is can we recover gamma from lambda gamma? So this is the idealized model. So can we recover the conductivity inside? So here is your matrix or function. And you want to recover the electrical properties inside by making just measurements on the boundary, electrical measurements on the boundary of the domain. And mathematically, this can be decomposed in several parts. So we consider this map. So here is one of the things you have to decide in what spaces you're going to consider this problem. This is a nonlinear map, as we're going to see, does not depend linearly on the conductivity, in contrast with the case that you already saw, the X-ray tomography, which is a linear map. For, you know, when you integrate along X-rays of a function, this is just linear function. Much more is known about this problem. So mathematically, there are several questions you can propose. One is the question of uniqueness. If two conductivities give the same measurements on the boundary are the same. So this is called the identifiability problem. Can we identify uniquely the conductivity if you make all measurements on the boundary? There's a very important question of stability. It's also called continuous dependence. If lambda gamma 1 is close, if the measurements are close to each other, to lambda gamma 2, does this imply some topology to be decided? Now this implies that gamma 1 is close to gamma 2. It's called also continuous dependence. The third question, of course, is very important from the practical point of view, is reconstruction. This is analytic reconstruction. Is, you can find a formula or a procedure for lambda gamma. Okay. And then the next step, of course, is numerical. To develop a numerical algorithm, and here you want to reconstruct approximately the conductivity using that reconstruction algorithm, and we have only finite number of measurements, and that always creates a problem. So find approximate reconstruction. And very related question to this one is, and very difficult question from the mathematical point of view, is the question is, what's the range of this map, lambda? The question is, what possible measurements can you make? Can you characterize all the possible measurements? Of course, that will depend on the space that you take here. And this is a very important question. Please stop me at any moment. From the practical point of view as well, not just mathematically, because in general, there's always noise in the measurements. They're not precise. You're not going to be measured exactly the Dirichlet Neumann map or some conductivity. There will be some noise. And then you want to project into the range. So you know what the range is. Then you can do this projection, and then you have a better chance of having a good numerical reconstruction. Of course, and finally, this is not for the mathematicians, but it's the implementation. It's not the same to develop a numerical algorithm and to devise a machine and make the measurements in practice. There is a big gap there also. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is actually a method that has given some insight in all of these problems. But of course, I only have 3 lectures. I'm going to concentrate mainly on this one. But the method actually, as I said earlier, gives at least partial answers in all of these questions. But before doing that, I'm going to actually talk about the direct problem. So this is the inverse problem, which will be the one and a half lectures, I guess. The first 1.5 will be the direct problem. And you have been doing this. How to solve this equation. In fact, we can put any right hand side that you want, and what spaces and so on, and also what are the properties, how to define precisely this map that I indicated before. What are the properties of this map? And properties and then we are going to start attacking the inverse problem. Yeah? So this is just to give you an idea where we are going. But I won't have time to talk about all these other things. I wrote a long survey paper that I can give copies to if anybody wants.
This would be a mass thing? Or?
Yeah, that and also have a longer survey paper too.
Which one do you want us to distribute?
Let me look after okay. To this one. Okay. So here you have to tell me how much you have covered.
You have a class, but also we have many people who are not in the class, so this is a special.
I see.
So the class is a subset of this crowd. So
okay.
This is complicated.
So how should I go?
So just lecture in your style and don't worry about the class.
I see. So I don't have to do several spaces and all this. The direct problem?
No. I mean, of course, well, the direct problem, but not to find someone.
Oh, I see. Okay. So let me just very quickly tell you how to solve the Dirichlet, how to do this, and how to solve the Dirichlet problem. Okay, so we have the space. So what I want to do is actually solve a more general equation. Equal to F. So the first thing is, what does it mean U restricted to the boundary is equal to F? So one uses the restriction theorem. The restriction theorem says the following, that you have, let me take H1, because that's the case I'm going to use. H1 means all the derivatives, has derivatives of first order in L2. The functions in L2, yes, very quickly. And the gradient is also in L2. Mm-hmm. So the restriction map, it goes from C-infinity functions in omega closure to C-infinity functions on the boundary. So to a function U, you restrict it to the boundary. That makes sense because this function has all derivatives up to the boundary. This extends as a bounded linear map from H1 omega to H1 half of the boundary. So you lose half a derivative when you restrict to the boundary. And this is true for any solid space actually bigger than a half. Okay. And the kernel of this map is the space H1 0. So these are the elements of H1 whose restriction is zero at the boundary. And this is just a completion of C infinity zero of omega. under the H1 norm. So the H1 norm is the norm of the gradient square plus the norm L2 square. Okay? And moreover, the range is everything. So given any function in H1 half, you can find a function in H1 whose restriction is that function. Okay, so that's a very important theorem, which is the key to how to solve this Dirichlet problem. Okay, so what should be the right space for F? And if the function is in H1, say, if u in H1 has one derivative in L2, then this map, this operator, can be seen to be in H minus 1 of omega. And because you are taking two derivatives of something in H1, and this is interpreted as the dual of H1 0 omega. So these are all the linear functionals from linear and continuous from H1 0 to C. So then this means the right space for the F should be H minus 1 omega. If are going to take u's in H1, since the restriction of elements in H1 is in H1 half, this is should be in H1 half. Is this too elementary? I don't know.
Close.
It's okay? You know, I had to get a feeling of where I'm going here. And the reason for this is that you
define H1 half quickly.
Sorry?
Maybe you want to define H1 half quickly.
Okay. So let me define what is H1 half, HS in any of RK, for every K. So that's this is any S. This measures regularity of distributions. Right? So these are distributions, and in fact, temporary distributions, so that the Fourier transform this is final. Okay, so this measures regularity. For instance, if S is an integer, I'm confusing with this, S equal to n, an integer, Hn of Rk is the same space as u is in L2, and all the derivatives are in L2 for alpha less or equal than k. You can check this as an exercise. So what this does is measures regularity. You are taking S derivatives of a function in...
You want S over 2 there?
No, S...
Hold on.
No, I want S. Oh. S over 2 is the...
No, the Fourier square.
The Fourier square, right. It's always a problem with me, anyway. Okay, so H1 half means you have one half derivative in L2. That's what it is. This is a very important concept of fractional derivatives. And when you have a boundary... What the definition of a domain with smooth boundary says that you can map every point in the boundary, this part, right? You can find a change of variables, a diffeomorphism, chi, mapping it to the upper half plane. The first component is positive. You can find always a diffeomorphism mapping, and this is the definition of a manifold with boundary, and you can do this through every point. So what you do is locally here in this patch, so you take this restriction, so U is an H1 half of the boundary. If when you map it here, the transform map, so let me, the transform function, let me call it chi star of U, is in H1 half of R n minus 1. This is very roughly speaking. This means U composed with chi inverse. So you map it back here by the diffeomorphism. So locally, it looks like a half space. The boundary looks like the boundary of the half space. And H one half of the boundary means that this is in one half R in minus 1, and then you do this for every piece of the boundary. It's a finite number of pieces because this is compact.
You're always assuming the boundary is codimension 1.
Yes, the boundary is codimension 1. In fact, I'm assuming it's smooth, although one can just probably do C2 or things like that. Always codimension 1, right. Okay, so the theorem, this is the main first theorem of the Dirac problem. And there are many ways to do this. So assume that gamma ij is a, I'm going to assume is uniformly elliptic. Through the closure of the domain. So given f in h minus 1 of omega and f in h 1 half of the boundary, the resist unique U in H1, so solves the equation L gamma of U is equal to F in omega. So I will explain what this means more precisely in a moment. And the restriction, which I will denote by U restricted to the boundary, is F. So there is a unique solution of the Dirichlet problem. Okay. So let me explain a little bit what means this part. This means in the weak sense, because I recall that this space H minus 1 is the dual space. So L gamma U equal to F means the following. Means you apply F to B. Remember, this is a map. So this should be equal to gamma ij sum du dxi dv dxj in omega with a minus sign for all v in H1, 0. Okay, so what I did here, I integrated by parts. So that's what I mean in the weak sense. But this is the definition. So I pass the derivative here. And since V is zero at the boundary, because it's in H0, 1, then I get this term here. So this is the definition of what it means to solve the equation weakly. Okay? Of course, in the case that gamma is small, this coincides with the notion of distributions, solving in the sense of distributions. So this is equal to, please correct me the signs, because I'm very bad with signs. Okay, moreover, and this is the direct problem, is there is a very good stability estimate for this. The H1 norm is bounded by a constant, depends on omega and the dimension norm of the data. You can put square or not, whatever you want. That's norm F square. So this is continuous dependence of the data. If you move a little bit the data here, then the solution also moves a little bit. It's going to be close. So this is actually very different from what happens in most inverse problems. There are usually much weaker stability estimates than this one. But the direct problem is very well posed. Okay, so this is the main theorem. And the second main theorem, and then I will indicate how to prove both of them. Theorem, if gamma is actually just L infinity, that's the only assumption I need. Lambda gamma can be defined as a bounded linear continuous map from H1/2 to H-1/2. Put theorem 1 here. This is going to be theorem 2. Half of the bounded is linear continuous self-adjoint a positive. Okay. So positive means lambda gamma F comma F is bigger equal than zero for all F. Okay. So H minus a half is defined exactly the same way, right? That was described, I erased it already before, yes. It's negative all spaces. So that means you're losing one derivative. This map acts like differentiation. We're losing one derivative when we apply this map. If gamma is smooth, in fact, this is what's called a pseudo-differential operator of order one. Okay, so I will give an indication of how to prove this. Is that the right tone or not? Yes? Okay. Because I could certainly assume it and go on to the inverse problem, but I don't know. It's up to you, not to me. Question? Okay, so let me just prove theorem one. So sketch. Theorem one. Okay, so the idea is actually is implicit. There are many ways to solve the Dirichlet problem. Everybody has his own favorite way of doing it. Which is your favorite?
This one.
This one? Sorry?
Right?
Well, it's sort of a mixture of Hilbert and variational. Yes. But there are, you can do potential theory, many, many ways. Probability theory, there are some probabilities here, many.
Okay. You can give us a proof in
Brownian motion. Right, you can do it using Brownian motion. Depends on what you want to do. I'm going to do some proof because I want to get quickly to this property of the Dirichlet-Neumann map, that's all. There's no other reason. Okay, the idea is actually based on this definition. You want to solve this equation. So remember, let me denote F applied to V as FB, if B is in H1, 0, omega. Remember, these are all the functions that in H1 that vanish at the boundary. Is to do this, right? This is what you want to prove with a minus sign or something. Okay, so sum here. So the idea is actually to change a little bit the inner product that you are defining. Instead of the usually H1, you define an inner product which I will call H1 gamma of omega, which is going to be, by definition, the integral gamma ij du dxi dv dxj, and however, this is not going to be an inner product. It's not a norm. If u is equal to b, the fact that this will be 0 doesn't mean that u will be 0. For instance, constants annihilate this. So I'm going to add something at the boundary. Is f, by the way, I'm going to use inner product here. Instead of writing conjugate, I'm just going to assume everything is real and write it this way, not to write the conjugate. FGDS, this is surface mesh. And F is a restriction of U, G is a restriction of V, and I'm assuming from the beginning that H and B, U and B are in H1. So now it's easy to check that this is indeed an inner product. It's a norm. Because if this is zero, so exercise, or the many exercises that I will assume here, this is an inner product. If, for instance, if the norm, when B is equal to U, this is 0, this part tells you it's constant, and this part tells you it's 0, because it's 0 at the boundary. Okay, the first proposition is that this norm, the norms are equivalent. Anybody, should I give this as an exercise? Exercise 2. The first exercise, I can see here there are some experts. It's a little bit hard to have the right level here. This is equivalent. This actually follows from Poincaré's inequality. One side follows, and you can see it in the notes. Yes. Maybe those are the... Is that the...
It's CBMS.
Right. Those are... It's in the notes anyway. Yeah. I think you cover Poincaré's inequality. Okay. And so the space H1, as before, can be denoted... let me put 0. Can be written as two parts and the perpendicular with respect to the inner product. So this is again is the completion of C0 infinity of omega under the H1 gamma norm. The same definition as before. In fact, this is the same as norm space as H10, right? It's the same space. The inner product is different. The norms are equivalent. Okay. So let's start with the part of the restriction. We want to remember that's what we want to do. The easy, let's take the easiest part. We want to restrict U and solve for V, solve for F. So given F in H1/2 of the boundary, I know by the restriction theorem that exists U in H1 so that the restriction of U is equal to F. In fact, if this is the same as the space H1 gamma, right? We know that the restriction map is onto. Okay, but now U can be written in two parts, U1 plus U2. Right? So using this space, I can write it in two parts. U1 is in H1 gamma 0 of omega, and U2 in H1 gamma 0 omega perpendicular. Right? I can decompose my U in this way. Now, the restriction of this one is 0. Right? The restriction of this other one is what? Is F, because the restriction of U is F already. So I'm going to take U2 to be the one whose restriction is F. The reason is the following, that this does not affect this equation at all. So let me explain that. I want to leave this this here. If for any element in H1 gamma 0 of omega perpendicular, you have that the inner product, the gamma inner product of U2 and V is 0 for all V in H1 gamma 0 of omega. By definition of being in the orthogonal complement. But what does this mean? This means gamma ij the inner product has this part and this at the boundary, but B is 0 at the boundary. I'm going too fast. This is equal to 0 for all V. But this is the definition. Remember the weak definition of the equation L gamma of U2 is equal to 0. Right? So this U2 solves the right boundary condition and doesn't do anything about this element here. Okay? So, and the restriction is equal to F. In fact, for the inverse problem, this is the problem we want to solve. No, we don't want the general right-hand side, but I will need estimates related to this problem later on anyway. Okay, so how do we solve for the F now, for capital F? And the restriction of U is equal to 0, right? We want to solve. So that now the combination of these two, this one plus this one, will give you what you want, because this is equal to 0 and the restriction is F here. But F, I recall, is in H1 is in this space, dual, right? Because this is H minus 1. Remember, H minus 1 is the dual of this space. This space coincides with the space H1, 0 of omega. So this is a linear map linear and continuous. By the Ries representation theorem, right? Any continuous linear, this is a Hilbert space. It's a closed space of a Hilbert space, it's a Hilbert space. Can be written as some element, let me call it U, V. In H1 gamma of omega with V is in H1 gamma 0 of omega. There is a unique U, and moreover, the norm of U is equal to the norm of F. I'm not going to write. That's the Ries representation theorem. Every linear continuous map has a unique representative, and U is in H1, 0. Right? This is for all V. And this is exactly the equation. Right? This is the definition. It's by definition, right? This is exactly... Remember I pointed out, that's why you define this inner product, because this is exactly the definition of L gamma of U is equal to F. This is equivalent. Moreover, the restriction of U is zero because U is in H0 gamma. And that's it. So it consists of two parts, the solution, then is the U that we just constructed. Plus the U2 that we have from before. So it's a very abstract way of doing it, but works. Works in quite generality, right? I mean, as long as you can define these inner products, so you have to have some positive definite conditions, works. And the estimate follows by the construction and the restriction theorem, because the norm of U is equal to the norm of F by the Ries representation theorem. The norm of U2 by the restriction theorem is less or equal than the norm of F. So the estimate follows immediately from this construction. Okay. Should I stop now or?
Yeah, you need a break.
No, you need a break.
Yeah, let's have some coffee.
Okay. I would like to get more sense of what is the right level. You know, I can go much higher or I can also... you know, do more of the details of this, but...
Can we vote? I mean, this is fine.
You can whisper in Gunter's ears over coffee.
Yeah, you tell me without Nassif being present. Or Joe.
I go and yell at my students.
Nassif says it's a very functional analytic way. But however, we can always get the variational approach that you like very easily. Let's take a case F equal to 0. Just for simplicity. It also can be done in this case. And you consider what's called the Dirichlet integral, which is the sum of this, when U, let me call it a W, sorry, call it W here. W is in H1, so one derivative in L2, and W restricted to the boundary is F. So consider this particular F. Okay? So the solution U of in H1 of L gamma of U is equal to 0 and the restriction of U is equal to F is the minimum D of U is the infimum of all of this where the restriction at the boundary is equal to F. And it's actually taken. So in other words, the infimum of this quadratic form with boundary data F with functions in H1 is given by the solution U of the equation. So, and this is another way to solve the problem, by the way. You can try to minimize this quadratic form, so you perturb it on W plus epsilon phi, W plus epsilon phi, take the derivative with respect to epsilon, and then you will get the solution of the equation. You have to prove that this works, but this is another approach. So to show this, it's very easy. I miss a 1/2 here, I guess. Let's take any W in H1 with the restriction of W is equal to F and U the solution. With the same boundary data. So you compute the Dirichlet integral of U minus W, this is done in the notes, by the way. So everybody has a copy of these notes?
Students, but we can provide copies to anybody who likes.
Okay, because this is done in more details in the notes. So you consider this, and then you check that this is the Dirichlet integral of W minus the Dirichlet integral of U, plus the integral I have to look at the formula because the signs change here. So this is a formula you can check. This is the next exercise. So you compute the Dirichlet integral of the difference. This quantity applied to the difference. And this is what you just do it, and this is what you get. And the point is this, U minus W is in H1, 0. Because the boundary values are just 0. So this is equal to 0 by the definition of the equation. Remember, the weak form of the equation says that this is equal to 0 for every B in H1, 0. And this is in H1, 0, so this is 0. So the U minus W is always dW minus dU. This is the crucial thing. This is, of course, always positive by definition. And so you get that dW minus dU is always bigger or equal than 0. So the infimum is taken at the solution U. Okay, so this is a very quick way of proving the variational formula. As I said earlier, there are many, many ways to solve the Dirichlet problem. Whatever, there's many favorite ways. This is not really my favorite way. My favorite way is potential theory, because it's more explicit. However, this gives you the quickest way to show that there is a solution in the right spaces with the right bounds that I need for the Dirichlet to Neumann map. Okay, so now we can define the Dirichlet to Neumann map. This is was the second theorem I stated of the direct problem. And then we're going to go to the inverse problem. What are the properties of lambda gamma? So I'm going to show the theorem 2, at least part of theorem 2, that this is a bounded map for h1 half to h minus half. Also, you will see from this this is self-adjoint in the way we prove this. I'm positive. This is bounded. Okay. So let's take U and V in H1. And I'm going to assume for the moment, so first I'm going to define it for, before we just assumed that the functions gamma ij were in L infinity, just bounded functions. We didn't need anything else. But here I'm going to assume a little bit more regularity, C1, as one derivative. Just because I want to do the integration by part. So the and I don't have that V vanishes at the boundary now. V dx. So this is a very important computation. Again, the signs are going to kill me here. So this is equal to gamma ij du dxi dv dxj plus or minus. Well, since I know the final formula, gamma ij, so I apply just Green's theorem. So here I'm using the fact that gamma is C1, U is in H1, and V is in H1. So all of this is valid. Gamma ij, du, in fact, I'm going to assume that U, I can assume anything that I want. Let me assume just H2 to be absolutely sure that every computation is kosher. Xi, mu j, v, ds. Just Green's theorem. So I put enough regularity conditions so that Green's theorem is valid. Right. So I have a minus sign somewhere. Right? Minus sign. Mm-hmm. That's Green's theorem. Right? For and so this is the jth component of the unit norma, the surface mesh. And this is the key reason to define the Dirichlet norma map in this form. If U is a solution of this, this is zero. And we get yes. Right? That's what we get for the solutions of the equation. But this is nothing else but what? This is nothing else but lambda gamma of F. Remember the definition of the if restriction of U is F. So I'm going to assume that F is in, say, H3 half of the boundaries of the solution U is in H2, say. Hmm? A little bit more regularities in order to have U in H2. One more derivative. Comma G, where G is a restriction of V. Hmm? So this is actually key identity. Lambda gamma F, comma G, the inner product in L2. Of the boundary, right, is equal to this, well, it's always a sum here, right, to this expression on the left, which is related to the quadratic form, it's the bilinear form. Okay, so from here you can derive the following inequality. Boundary is less or equal than a constant. Remember, these are bounded functions. Question?
Yes. Just,
Yeah, no, let me know. That's helpful. Oh, that's the unit. It's my V and the mu are. I wonder what the people in the watching this are going to see. The J's component of unit normal. That's what comes from integration by parts. Okay, so this is the same, and it's bounded by the H1 norm of omega. It doesn't matter if you use an H2, but I'm going to, I can estimate it by the norm U in H1 times the norm V in H1. Now, by restriction theorem, one half. Right. So, is that clear? That's just I'm applying the restriction theorem for. So the supremum of all of this is bounded by a constant times the norm of F in H one half of the bound. But what is this? Now here, right, because the norm of G is 1. Why am I doing this? I don't know whether you did you saw the relation between HS and H minus S? Okay, I will review this, but this is the H minus a half norm. I will explain this in a moment, so bear with me. HS and H minus S are dual of each other in the L2 inner product. So therefore, this is by definition, in fact, the H minus a half norm of the bound. So therefore, you have the estimate that you want. This is true. I will explain this, okay? This step, which I... This is true for all F in H3 half. We need a little bit more regularity to do all the integration by parts and so on. However, since C infinity is dense in this space, if this is valid in H1 half, you can extend it all the way to H1 half by continuity. Whenever you have an estimate valid in some space, which is better than you started with, is you can extend it to that space, right? That's a standard. In fact, I could have started with F smooth and then get this inequality, and then this proves that lambda gamma is a map, continuous and linear map from H1 half to H minus a half on the map. It's bound. Continuous map. So let me explain a little bit about this duality. Okay, so HS are, so let me do for in k-dimensional space. The same arguments apply to the boundary. It's a little bit more complicated, but the same idea. It's the dual of H minus S of RK with respect to L2. The L2 in the product, of course, the dual of Hilbert space is itself, right, with respect to the inner product in HS. But with respect to the L2, this is the dual of HS is much H minus S. This is very important because whenever you prove something for positive Sobel spaces, which is the standard thing, you can do it for negative Sobel spaces. This is a very useful technique. So let me indicate how this goes. So let's take U in HS. So So I'm being in H Manasas. So what's the inner product? I want to do the inner product in L2. And again, I'm going to be use the real, instead of putting conjugates here, I'm going to put just real. Hope this is okay. I hope nobody's listening now. You know, after I gave the lecture in the PIMS lecture in a couple of years ago, I got many emails from people I didn't know that asking me about this or that of the lecture. So this is very dangerous.
Did you say bad things about
me? Why didn't you refer to me, you know, in the lecture? Okay, so. Okay, so what I mean here, to be completely precise, I should use conjugates here. Particularly when you're using the Fourier transform, when it's not going to be real in general, but, let me just do it. Okay, so this is the inner product. Why does this make sense? Because you can write this as 1 plus C squared to the power S over 2 here. Here I had to put S over 2. Times 1 plus C squared minus S over 2 dC, right? These two cancel, so by Cauchy-Schwarz, this is bounded by this times to 1/2 times to the S, to the minus S, DC, to the 1/2. Right? So this is finite, because U is in HS, and V is in H minus S. Okay, so the inner product in L2 is well defined. Right, is that clear? So now, why is it the dual? So the really small exercise here. The operator identity minus Laplacian to the power S over 2 maps HS. In fact, any k, any n, to h n minus s of r k. So Laplacian here is, of course, as usual, the standard Laplacian. This is the identity minus Laplacian. So the identity minus Laplacian, this is the fractional powers of the Laplacian applied to a function, is just it's the Fourier transform. So that's the S over 2, thank you. Okay, that's the Fourier transform of this is 1 plus C squared Fourier transform. Maybe I should put 1 over 2 pi into the end, but I don't care about that. So this is very, these are called Bessel fractional powers, are the ones who reduce the regularity S. You take S, identity minus Laplacian, S over 2 derivatives, you lose S derivatives. And this is an isomorphism by Planck-Cherel, because the integral of the Fourier transform the same as up to a constant. So this is a way to move from Sobol space to another Sobol space. By, right? Is that? You look startled.
Oh, you said those two are isomorphic.
Isomorphic, yeah. I mean, it's an isomorphic. Given any element here, there is an element here, so it's the image here. Do you want me to prove it?
No.
It's just this fact. It's exactly this fact. You see, this raises, put the 1 plus c squared that you need in order to have it in the right place. Okay. This is a very fast introduction, but I hope. And so, why HS is the dual of H minus S? Is simply the fact you take a function and linear continuous. So that means A belongs to HS or N dual, right? That's the dual space. Then by the representation theorem, this can be represented by some function G in HS. But you do a small exercise here by using this fact. This is the identity minus Laplacian S over 2 of some function G tilde in L2, where the G tilde is in L2 now. So I change from HS to L2 by this, because that changes me the power, 1 plus c squared s over 2. And that's what's involved here. And this is in H minus S. The G tilde, this is in H minus S. The G tilde is in L2. I can put actually, just the G. This is just the G. This is just the definition. This is the HS in the product. This is the L2 in the product. I can put this here because of the 1 plus C squared S over 2 in the Fourier transform. I'm using, again, Plancherel identity. And so, and this is in H minus S. It's not G tilde. It's G itself. So any continuous linear functional can be represented by an element in H minus S with respect to L2. And that's what I meant here, that HS is the dual of H minus S. This is very, very useful. Okay, so that's the way you compute the norm. So to compute the norm, lambda gamma, we prove this in L2. This is what we prove, right? The supremum. H 1 half equal to 1. And that's exactly the H minus a half norm of this. By, remember, the norm of an operator is the supremum if it's self-adjoint AXY, norm of X, norm of y equal to 1. Right? So this is the kind of things that I'm using. I just want to use the norm of this. I'm not using the operator itself. The norm of this in h minus 2 can be estimated. You take all elements g in h 1 half, you take the inner product in L2. Okay, that's a general. Okay. So, let me do something about the inverse problem to end. So now for gamma and L infinity, we used that gamma was C1 to do the integration by parts. We just define, by definition, Right? Just use this as a definition. When you solve the equation, V is a function in H1, restriction of V is G, and U is in H1, and F is in H1 half. That's what it came from the discussion before. Remember, the integration by parts, I erased it already, led to this formula. But we cannot do the integration by parts because the gamma is not smooth enough. However, we can define this as your object, and this is well defined. Okay. So here it comes a very important, and you can deduce all the other properties of the Dirichlet Neumann map that I mentioned from this. For instance, it's positive, G is equal to F, self-adjoint, you can put it here or here, doesn't matter. All the properties of lambda gamma can be deduced from there. It's a very important thing. This is the key observation of Calderón, which I was going to start now. It's very important for the inverse problems. If you take lambda gamma F is this quadratic form that we defined at the beginning. Remember that was the U solves the equation. Again, it's always a sum here, dx. We have this formula. It's just immediate from there. Lambda gamma F, F dx. Again, I'm going to use the real in the product. So this quadratic form, the Dirichlet, was called the Dirichlet integral, is given by this formula. I'm just taking U equal to V in this expression here. And U is the solution of the equation. Why is this important? And of course, you have the corresponding bilinear form, right? Is that clear? This is a key thing. And here you can see also the non-linearity of the problem. Because U is a solution of this equation depends on gamma. This is quadratic non-linearity in gamma. And you have a gamma there. Yeah, so this is very non-linear. So what this formula tells us is that given Q gamma or lambda gamma are equivalent information. Okay, so you can give the lambda gamma, give rise to the Q gamma, and vice versa. Lambda gamma is the linear map associated to this quadratic form. So why, and Q gamma F has also its own physical interpretation. Let me write it once more. This is the power needed to maintain F on the boundary. This is the Dirichlet integral. Always forget the sum, induce the solution of this equation. Okay, so this ends sort of the first part I was talking about, the direct problem. I went a little quick, but it is in the notes in more detail. Any questions, I will be here these 3 days, so you can ask. So now I'm going to start talking about the inverse problem. So the inverse problem can reformulate. can we determine gamma from Q gamma? That is equivalent. To give lambda gamma or Q gamma is exactly the same thing. Okay, why is this any better? So this, as I said, this was the point of view of Calderón, to consider this quadratic form instead of the Dirichlet random map. The reason is the following. You know, what we're trying to do is put electrodes around here, put currents or voltages, and measure the current. But which voltages are you going to put? So you don't want to put too high voltages so you don't kill the patient, of course. But you are allowed otherwise any voltage that you want. But which ones? So that's a very complicated question to address. I mean, what voltages F to put on the boundary? So in order to recover the conductivity, that's what we want to do. The point of view of this quadratic form, although they are equivalent formulations, is that instead of looking at Fs, you look at solutions of the equation. So we are going to construct solutions of this equation. Many solutions. Enough so that this, when you substitute into this, we can recover gamma. It will be an eternal problem for the next 3 days. Right? Is that clear? This is, I want to. This is a conceptual difference that's very important. We want to construct solutions of the question. I will change the emphasis. Instead of trying to try many currents here and see what happens, and a lot of people do that, I would rather look for enough solutions of the equation so that when I take the products of these derivatives, I get enough information to recover the conductivity gamma. Okay? Then, the voltage potentials will be just the solutions U that I constructed restricted to the boundary. I solve that problem later. I first construct solutions, and then the boundary values of those solutions are the ones I'm going to put in when I do the experiments to reconstruct the conductivity in the interior. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, so Calderón did this, and I'm going to, for the linearized problem, and I'm going to come back to this starting next time, but let me, I'm not going to do the calculation today, but I'm going to present this point of view in for the linearized problem. So Calderón, he took first an, is there a better solution of this, Sandy? Maybe there. Okay, so what Calderón did is he took isotropic conductivities, and actually I'm going to stick to isotropic for a while. Remember, isotropic meant that this is a multiple of the Kronecker delta. So it's just a diagonal matrix. Behaves the same in every direction. Alpha is positive. And he took perturbations, well, he linearized the problem near conductivity gamma equal to gamma zero, isotropic. Okay, so remember this map, gamma to Q gamma or lambda gamma is nonlinear, highly nonlinear because of this. What does it mean linearized? It's the Fréchet derivative. What I mean is I take gamma plus epsilon H. In fact, I can do linearization, can be done anisotropic, but let me just do it. And I'm going to take boundary data F and G at gamma zero. And I'm going to take the limit as epsilon goes to zero divided by epsilon. Okay. Remember, Q gamma zero of FG is the bilinear form associated to this quadratic form. It's just gamma ij, du dxi, dv dxj, where u and v solves the equation now. And restriction of u is f, and restriction of v is g. So it's the bilinear form associated to this quadratic form. Okay, so I'm going to do the calculation next time, or perhaps you can read it in the chapter, I think it's 4 in the notes, or 3 or 4. This is equal, or H is 0 at the boundary. So what we're doing here is perturbing your conductivity in the direction of H, taking the derivative in the direction of H. And the calculation, you can also do it yourselves, but and you have to use the estimates that I just proved to do this. I was planning to do it in detail, but I'll do it if you want me next time. It's the integration of H gradient U dot gradient V dx. Well, U solves the equation at gamma zero. Remember, this is at the background conductivity. This is gamma zero. You are perturbing it in this direction. This is now linear, right? This is linear in H. It's a linear map in H. Okay. So let me call this dq gamma zero F and G in the direction H. It's a little bit complicated, but this is the Fréchet derivative dx. Okay? So this is a general calculation. You can also do it for anisotropic, but I'm not going to do it. Now, Calderon, consider the case when gamma zero is 1. It's a constant. The background conductivity is constant. In this case, the equation L gamma, remember L gamma is the divergence of gamma gradient U, is nothing else but the divergence of the gradient, which is the Laplacian. So the equation is Laplacian U equal to zero. Laplacian V equal to zero. So U at the boundary is F, and V at the boundary is G. Okay? So the linearized problem is, can we recover the perturbation H from this information? So gamma, let me just put gamma zero, F, G, the direction H. Can we recover H? Not the conductivity, but the perturbation. Okay? As I said before, in the case of gamma zero is 1, so Calderon considered the case where this is zero, so the injectivity of the linearized problem And you get the integral h gradient u dot gradient v is 0 for every harmonic function u and v equal to 0. And that's it. Question, is h equal to 0? In other words, is the products of gradients of harmonic functions dense? That's what I came back to the original, what I was telling before, looking at this quadratic form. Is it true that you can construct enough solutions so that the products of the gradients is dense, or harmonic functions? And nobody has looked at this question before, incredibly enough. As far as I know, maybe. So is the products of gradients of harmonic functions dense, say in L2, for instance, some space like this. Right? That's the question. And then, just to finish, I will come back to this next time. So, but you can think about this. He took the following harmonic function, e to the x dot rho, a complex exponential, a complex plane wave, where rho is a complex vector, so that rho dot rho is equal to 0. So rho has components rho 1, rho n. They are all complex numbers. So rho dot rho means rho 1 squared plus rho n squared. These are not positive, they're complex numbers. It's very simple. These are harmonic functions because the Laplacian of this is rho dot rho. Okay. So I'm going to go a little quick here since I'm running out of time, but I will come back to this next time. Rho can be written in the real and imaginary part. Rho dot rho is equal to 0 is equivalent to the length of the real part is equal to the length of the imaginary part and then being perpendicular. You can check. This is the next exercise. So take any vector k, any perpendicular vector with the same length will give you the real part. Okay, so it's codimension 2, real and manifold. Okay, so Calderón took that u and v to be e to the minus x dot rho conjugate. Because minus rho conjugate is minus eta plus ik. And just now you plug it in into this identity and you get k squared integral e to the 2ix, maybe you get a 2, but it's equal to 0 anyway, h dx equal to 0. Because when you add up these complex exponentials, you get x dot k. And k is a real vector. So you get h times the characteristic function of omega, the Fourier transform, 2k, times k squared is equal to 0 for all k. This implies this is an L2 function. Doesn't matter what happens at k equal to 0. It's just an L2 function. The values at one point doesn't matter. H equal to 0 on omega. And this also gives you a reconstruction. It's not just uniqueness, because if you know this, you can get the Fourier transform.
The second part is the proof that this is the best.
Yeah.
So using
this exponential u,
yeah,
and this exponential v, which are harmonic functions,
okay,
because of these complex frequencies. And I choose them so that the real part, the growing part, cancels out, and I get only an oscillating factor. And So at the end of the day, I get this. I may be wrong by a factor here. In fact, I'm wrong by a factor, but it's equal to zero, so I'm safe. And that's it. So these simplest complex exponentials provide the voltage potential you had to put at the boundary. Now you go back to the original problem, and you put this at the boundary, and that's what you had to do. The question is how to implement that. That's a different question, but that's... And this is only for the linearized problem. Okay. Next time I'm going to talk about the non-linear problem. But this is a basic idea, actually, to look at the solution. It's a very simple thing. I repeat once more, this identity is the crucial one. Because this allows you to look at solutions instead of putting voltages here. And from me, well, for Calderon, of course, too, first, coming from PDEs, you know, you look for solutions are much easier than, construct solutions is much easier than, I mean, how do you know what potentials to put?
A medical operator, how are you going to go inside?
Oh, well, you know, you take these exponentials. Now you go to the original problem. This tells you what is identity. What are they going to be the F? The boundary values of this. So you take the reals and imaginary parts, and those are the ones you try. And in fact, this has been tried for the linearized problem, and it works numerically. And it works very well. For the linearized problem, and close to the constants, works very well. I can give you some references. Eli Axelson and David Isaacson. I think I sent you the reference, remarks on Calderon's paper, something like this. Well, I hope I didn't scare everybody away. Yes.
These are important notions.
Right. No, I realized, but I wanted to finish with something like this so that people can think about it, and then I'll come back to this next time.
Yeah. These are two important concepts here. Mm-hmm.